Hello everyone, welcome to the interview with Chris Pritchard. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Okay, can you introduce yourself?
Absolutely. So my name is Chris Pritchard. I am a security consultant with Pentest Partners. And I've been in security for coming up on 15 plus years, I think.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
You have been in security for a long time.
I've been doing security for a long time, both from the sort of defensive side, which is where I started, and then the offensive side, probably just the last 6 years, I suppose.
Okay. So what does your job involve?
So the majority of my work is pen testing, and I have two specialist sort of skill sets, if you like, within the sort of standard pen testing. So I can do standard pen testing, whether that's, you know, infrastructure, web applications, etc. But I have two specialist skills on top of that, and the first one is industrial control systems, and so I'm known for testing industrial control systems, which is quite unusual and quite a specialist.
SCADA systems, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And the other skill set that I have that I've sort of known for a little bit is social engineering and sort of getting into buildings.
Yeah. That's what's about your talk on how to start with social engineering.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. Talked to DEFCON 27. In the social engineering village about the basics of social engineering. And the reason for that talk was I felt that everyone thought that they had to know everything about body language and facial expressions to make a start in social engineering. And I didn't agree with that. I thought that was an artificially high barrier, because I don't have all of those skills, nor am I, you know, brilliant at all of those skills. And especially when I first started in social engineering, I didn't have any of those skills. But I don't think you necessarily have to have those skills to become successful. So yeah, the idea behind the talk was, here's some things that you can do that are relatively easy to do and will help you be successful in getting into buildings.
Yeah. The talk was great, actually, because I myself am starting to learn social engineering, so in some way it kind of helped me. So yeah, talk was great.
Good. That's good to hear. And that is exactly why I did that talk, to help people make a start.
Yeah. Okay, so can you tell us exactly, I mean, not exactly, but how did you start to get into security and especially into pen testing or social engineering?
Yeah, okay. I started off in IT support, and I'd always had an interest in the security side of things. And so was given the opportunity in one of my previous jobs to move from IT support into security, and that's how I started on my journey. I was very lucky and worked for a very supportive company that helped me and developed me. I sort of started progressing up the career chain, if you like, and became a supervisor and a team leader and then a manager. And I noticed two things. One, that I was relying less and less on my technical skills, which is the stuff that I really enjoyed. Noticed that I was sort of spending most of my time, you know, filling in spreadsheets and budgets and stuff like that. And I spent a long time trying to become more and more technical and didn't really want to lose that. And so the best option that I could see at the time was to to retrain and become a pen tester. So I put myself through some courses and then sat the exams in the UK to become a Czech registered tester, which is one of the UK standards for testing in government, and successfully passed that. And then I went out to market and said, right, I've got all this experience and all these this one qualification, are there any jobs available? And was lucky enough to get hired by Pentest Partners.
Yeah, that's a quite interesting story, because most of people who are in digital security eventually start to get into physical security because it's connected in some way. So yeah, it's an interesting story actually.
Yeah.
Okay, so has this pandemic affected your work or social engineering, or has it affected in some way about work?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really affected, obviously, the physical side of the social engineering.
Yeah.
The number of jobs that we've done around physical social engineering is much less than we would normally do, because of, you know, the situation. But there are opportunities in other areas, whether that be, you know, telephone social engineering or phishing and constructing good pretexts for phishing and stuff like that. So, you know, there's still stuff going on. It's just changed. The approach has changed slightly. We're not doing quite as much physical stuff as we were. I mean, last year was crazy. We did a lot of social engineering last year, not just in the UK, but where did I go last year? I was in Kuala Lumpur, Thailand, so I did some stuff in Singapore as well. So yeah, last year was crazy, but yeah, this year compared to last year, it's dropped off a lot. But yeah, it's okay. You just adapt and change
adapt and overcome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so you said that one of your specialties are social engineering, right?
Yeah.
So did the view of the world change for you? Because social engineering is actually some kind of discipline about humans and how humans react. So it's in some way your view of the world changed?
I think my understanding and my, you know, one of the things that I like to do to practice, if you like, my social engineering and have an understanding of people was interacting with them. And, you know, whether that was, but let's give you an example. So, you know, I'm a security consultant, I'm a pen tester, which often requires me to go to sites and perform, I don't know, so let's say an internal infrastructure test. Now, 9 times out of 10, when I go to those sites, I'm there for a week and I'm staying in a hotel because it's, you know, 2 hours or more drive away from my home. And what I would often do is in the evening is I would go down to the hotel bar or restaurant, or go to a restaurant outside of the hotel, and I would sit in a corner and have a really good view of the area that I'm in, and I would watch people. Because watching people and how people interact with one another in those kind of situations gives you a really good understanding of how humans interact with each other, and you know, helps you understand their body language and their facial expressions. And so because of the pandemic, the opportunities to do that are you know, significantly less. The number of times I've traveled this year is obviously a lot less. I have done some on-site stuff, but nowhere near as much as last year. So the opportunity for me to cement those skills and to cement how people interact with each other is less. But what I am doing and trying to do more is the human interactions that I am having. And let's say I'm going to the shops, I'm going to the supermarket, and I'm buying my food for the week or whatever. Those interactions are now more important to me than they were previously, because they are probably the only interactions I'm getting with human beings, you know? And so I'm putting a lot more emphasis on myself to make those interactions more valuable. And by that, you know, the world has changed and we're having to wear masks when we go shopping, which, you know, is a good thing. And it's also an opportunity to try and see how the world has changed. And so you look at people and go, okay, I can't see really somebody's mouth or their nose anymore. And so the facial expressions I'm looking for are literally from the mask upwards. And that's quite a limited view. And so you have to try and bring in more of the situation and the surroundings to try and gain an understanding of how that person is feeling and whether they're, you know, angry, sad, happy, whatever. So that's a challenge, definitely. And the other thing that I'm trying to do more is interact more, and this is difficult, but interact more with the staff around me, because, again, it's another human interaction. Those people are probably not getting a lot of human interaction either. And so if I can talk to them and make them happy or make them laugh, then to me that's beneficial, not only to them but also to me. So I'm trying to put effort into doing those things more than I probably would normally.
Yeah, because that's in this time, that's this one way to interact with people, and that's the key element of social engineering, actually. Everybody who wants to start social engineering should actually interact as much as they can with people, to try to talk to them, look at them, and as you said, to look at their body language, micro expressions, facial expressions, everything they can.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is most people, and I say most people have an innate, an inbuilt understanding of how the other person is reacting to the things that they are saying. And what if we want to be better social engineers, then we have to understand how people are reacting to things that we're saying. You know, if we're saying something bad, then people are going to respond badly. If we're saying something happy, which I'm suggesting is a good idea to do in these uncertain times, then pay real close attention to how the person you are talking to is reacting, because you're trying to make them feel happier. Are you actually achieving that? And you can tell that by looking at them, and you know, happiness or satisfaction is an easy expression to try and understand and decode from the other person. So it's a good thing to do. It's beneficial, but it's also practice, which you know, will help you later down the line when, you know, fingers crossed, things return back to normal.
Yeah. Okay. So after all this, would you say that understanding people's emotions and understanding people's body language is something that successful social engineers require?
Yes and no, and this goes back to that talk, that DEF CON talk. Don't have to know and understand body language and facial expressions to be a good social engineer. There isn't a barrier. Don't let it be a barrier. Don't say to yourself, I don't know body language, I don't know facial expressions, and so I shouldn't start social engineering. Don't do that. You can definitely start social engineering without those skill sets. And that was the whole premise of that DEF CON talk. Here are a whole load of things that you can do that will start you on the path to being a successful social engineer. And it's not amazingly clear in that talk, but it's in the title. The things that I'm telling you in that talk have got me, you know, and I haven't done anything crazy here. I haven't become this amazing social engineer that I am the best in the world. Absolutely not. The things, the techniques I'm telling you in that talk have got me into places where I definitely shouldn't be. You know, and I'm talking critical national infrastructure. Casinos. I'm talking airports. And those are basic techniques. And so if I can use basic techniques to get into those kind of places, you can do that too. So yeah, facial expressions and body language, they're useful tools, but you don't have to know those skills to make a start in social engineering. Once you've made a start and you're a little bit more comfortable with getting in and, you know, interacting with people, which, you know, you've practiced hopefully in the supermarket and, you know, places like that, then facial expressions and body language will help you. But they aren't the only tools that you need. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes clear sense. So thank you for that. Okay, but you said that it doesn't require anything of that. But what do you look, what skills do you look for when hiring someone for a SE job or physical pen testing job?
So this is a struggle question. It's a good question. It's a struggle to answer. I would look for somebody who is willing to learn, because, you know, the number of social engineers that are out there is probably pretty limited. And we've had a couple of people within our company who said, I want to learn social engineering. And I've taken them on jobs, and the guys that I've taken on jobs have both had a willingness to learn and have asked really relevant questions and have responded well to the actual situation. You've got to remember that, you know, if you're breaking into a casino, for example, the first time you do that, that is a very stressful situation. And so I guess one of the things that I'd be looking for is how they would handle that stress and that pressure. But if they've got a willingness to learn and a willingness to understand, then realistically speaking, then we should give them the opportunity, because that was the same opportunity I was given. I didn't know anything about social engineering, really, when I was offered to do my first social engineering job. I just asked lots of questions and said, yeah, I want to give this a go.
Yeah.
But I need to know some stuff first of all, but yeah, let me try. I'll give it a go. And so, yeah, if I was interviewing somebody, I would ask them, how do you feel about it? What would your approach be? How do you think you're going to handle the pressure? How do you think you're going to handle the stress? What research have you done into social engineering? That kind of thing. I'm not looking for skills, because most skills can be taught if there's a willingness to learn. And so for me, the willingness to learn is the first important thing.
Yeah, I understand you and I agree completely with you. Because if a person is not ambitious enough, you can hire them, but it's not the same thing as someone who has ambition to learn and to try new things and to successfully get in some places where he or she shouldn't be.
Yeah. And yeah. There has to be ambition is brilliant and really, really good. But there has to be an element of being humble as well. Because if you're not humble and you are very, very ambitious, there's a potential that you would become overexcited on the job, for example. And, you know, one of the things that we've got to remember when we're doing this kind of work is that the client comes to us, you know, the casino comes to us and says, this is what I want you to try and achieve. I want you to try and get in, and I want you to appear at my desk. That's brilliant. You're given a clear set of goals. If the person is too ambitious, they might go, well, that bit was easy, so I'm going to go and try and do this with the casino floor, or I'm going to try and break into the server room to show them how good I am. That isn't a good trait to have.
Yeah.
Because we're just trying to help a client. And this is something that I think is really important to remember. We're trying to help a client improve their security posture. We're not trying to break into a server room when the client has only asked us to appear at their desk. And the two things are very, very different. So ambition is absolutely very, very good. Willingness to learn is very good. But also being humble and understanding what the client is trying to achieve is also really important.
Yeah, so it's some kind of balance between ambition and humbleness.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Okay, so you said that you stumbled upon this job you have now, that you're actually in a digital part of security, so now you're in the physical part of it. So what would you say that your favorite part of your work is, and what's your least favorite?
Okay, so the favorite part of my work is testing a client that we've already tested and them taking on board the suggestions that you have put a lot of time and effort into researching and learning about, and then, you know, making those suggestions to the client and them actually taking them and going, yeah, that's really good, or we might need to change this a little bit, but I'm going to take these ideas on board and I'm going to help improve the business.
Yeah.
That's really good. So if I come back to that client a year later and I can see loads of improvements based on the recommendations from last year, for me, that is awesome. I love that. I absolutely love that because, you know, I put a lot of effort into, tailoring my jobs and my reports and stuff around the client, what I see, and the recommendations and stuff that I've seen work in other areas or other businesses, and I will tailor those recommendations to this particular client. So my favorite bit is if I come back and they've taken all that on board and they've improved, that is awesome. I absolutely love that. On the flip side, my least favorite bit is putting a lot of effort into a report and suggestions and recommendations and coming back the next year and finding it exactly the same. And yeah, they've made no effort whatsoever to do any of those changes or take on board any of those recommendations. That for me is very disheartening. Because, you know, we're all proud of our work, right? You know, if someone comes to us and hires us and says, we want you to do this, you don't do it because it's just a job, or I don't do it just because a job. I do it because I enjoy it. And we're very lucky to be in a situation where the things that we enjoy is actually our work. So if someone takes that work and that enjoyment and goes, Chris has made all these recommendations, but I'm not taking those. I'm happy that, you know, I don't believe what he's suggesting, or I'm not going to implement those changes. That's not great. That's pretty sad, really, for me. So yeah, that's my least favorite part of it.
Yeah, I understand you, because all your effort like just floats away and nobody cares about it. That's really an awful thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
And one of the things I will ask a client, you know, if a client comes to us and says, you know, next year, oh, well, Chris, we want you to do that test again. One of my first questions would be, yeah, sure. What improvements have you made since last year? Or have you made some improvements? Sometimes the client will go, I don't want to tell you the exact improvements that we've made because we want you to test those. And so I'll go, okay, that's fine. But you have made some improvements, right?
Yeah.
Or taken on board some of the suggestions. And if they go, no, I will seriously question, well, why are you wasting the money doing the test? Is it an audit exercise or something along those lines? But yeah, we all put a lot of effort into becoming better at the skills that we have and teaching ourselves and learning, etc. So if someone doesn't take that on board, then yeah, that can be quite disheartening.
Yeah, I believe. Okay, so what would you say is your biggest success in your career?
Cool, good question. biggest success. I think the most rewarding thing is helping other people. And that isn't just, you know, helping clients, but helping members of the team who are interested in the things that I know about and helping them learn those things. That's very rewarding. And seeing the people that, you know, I've helped go on and take that little bit of knowledge that I've given them, because I might only know a little bit about the thing that they've asked. And then they've taken that little bit and gone on and done more research and come back with more information. That is, I really love that. So that's a big success. And that's probably quite a strange success for, you know, when you ask people this question, that's probably quite a strange answer. But for me, that is the biggest success I think I can ever have, is to motivate people to do more, learn more, and share knowledge and information. That makes me very happy.
Yeah, that's actually the most important thing, because physical security is actually a small community, so we need to expand them. We need to tell other people what is it, what's about, how can they join, how can they learn something, and that's actually very noble.
Yeah, absolutely. It's important, I think. Like you say, it's quite a small community, and sharing how we do this stuff, to my mind, can only help other people and can only help the client, and as a result, that can only help, you know, the world, if you like, be a much more secure place.
Yeah. Okay. So now this next question, you actually kind of answered it. It's what is a good tip for someone who is just starting to learn about social engineering? So would you say a good tip is talk more to people or observe people and their behavior?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, some of this stuff is covered in that DEF CON talk. It's worth a watch. But I would suggest take an honest look at yourself and say, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? And work on those. Recognize those strengths and weaknesses. Don't necessarily obviously have to work on the strengths so much, but take a look at the weaknesses. And if, you know, if you're an introvert and your weakness is talking to people, practice that. Go into a supermarket and, you know, talk to the person who is, you know, checking out your food and your groceries and stuff, and just try and engage in conversation with them. And, you know, it's a bit like everything in the world. The more you practice those things, the better you become at them. But if you don't practice those things, and you then come to rely on them when you need them, i.e., when you're doing an actual social engineering job, if you haven't practiced them, then it's going to be a struggle. So yeah, take a look at yourself, an honest look at yourself. Think about the skills that you might need and think, where am I not great in those areas? And try and practice those things. There's some really great books out there as well. So there's a book called The Charisma Myth, which is really, really good. And that works brilliantly, not just for extroverts, but also introverts, about how to be charismatic, which is a good skill to have when you're doing social engineering. There's another really great book by a guy called Chris Voss, who used to be the sort of head international terrorist negotiator for the FBI. And his book is called Never Split the Difference. And his book is about negotiating. Now, he's coming at that book from, negotiating with terrorists and stuff like that to get hostages released and things like that. And he's putting those examples into things like, negotiating a better price when you go and buy a car and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But for us as social engineers, when we're interacting with people and we're trying to get into a building, or we're trying to get to a server room, or we're trying to get access into somewhere that we're not supposed to be, what we're actually doing is negotiating, right?
Yeah.
So take the things that he talks about in that book, take them out of the context that he is using them in as examples, but apply them to how we might social engineer into a building. Because essentially all we're doing really when we're interacting with people, when we're doing that portion of the job, is negotiating. That's a really good skill to have as well, and a good skill to practice and learn. The body language is good, and the micro expressions are good. But they're not key. I mean, there's definitely a lot of emphasis in the industry on having those. They're not the be all and end all. They're not the only skills that you need. They are useful.
As you said, they are tools.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. They are tools. So
they are tools that can help you, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay, now, I don't know if you did, I mean, you said you did some social engineering outside Europe, but I don't know if you did some social engineering in USA.
No, I haven't. I've done some physical access bypass stuff in the USA, but I haven't done any social engineering in the USA.
Okay, you're known, I mean, you know how security in USA is. So,
would
you say, how different are they, European or entire world and USA?
And they have a lot of guns in the US. They have a lot of guns in the USA. That's one big difference. I think, essentially, the awareness is probably pretty much the same around the world. Most companies that are mature have probably got some program that is there to raise awareness about social engineering and that sort of stuff. The difference is, for us as social engineers, how we approach those targets based on the location. So how I approach getting into an office in the UK compared to how I approach getting into an office in Thailand, compared to how I get into an office in the USA, will be different because the culture is different.
Yeah, culture is a key element to security.
Absolutely, yeah. And so that culture and how I can sort of tap into that culture to my advantage. You know, ultimately, I'm trying to do a job, and my job is to try and get into that building. And so how I approach that in the US as an English person, let's remember that, will be different you know, probably be different to how a US person approaches getting into a US building.
Yeah.
Because I've got, you might think that that is a weakness, a UK person trying to get into a US building. So how can I turn that into a positive and work that in my favor? So yeah, the approach will be different, but I, you know, realistically speaking, most places in the world are doing awareness of some description. It's just trying to work out how we can use those subtle differences to our advantage to try and complete the job.
Yeah, I understand. And that's, I asked this question to many people and they all say a culture is a big thing. And if you travel somewhere or do international or physical pen testing or social engineering, you have to understand their culture and how they do things. And as you said, everyone does some kind of security, social security training or awareness training, but it's key is how their culture is, I don't know how to say, agreeing with it, or just the most important thing is culture, understanding how they do things in that culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, we haven't really touched upon this, but this is that is the essential part of the research that you have to do before you go to the site. You know, we talk about doing OSINT, you know, open source intelligence and stuff like that around the building and the layout and all that sort of stuff. What we're not talking about, and we probably should be talking about, is exactly what you've just said, understanding the culture, especially if it's an international location that we're trying to get into.
Yeah. Okay, so as you said all this, would you say that social engineering is more art or more science?
I would go towards more science, mainly because, to my mind, nobody is born a natural, and people throughout their life get practice in certain things. Now, because of your life circumstances, the practice that you get might be completely different to somebody else, and that might put them in good stead for being more charismatic, for example. There's an amazing book by, I can't remember his name. I'm just trying to look on my bookshelf to see if I can see it. There's a book called Bounce, and it is written by a guy who was he was the world table tennis champion for sort of 4 or 5 years. He's a UK guy, and yeah, I can't see the book. Anyway, there's a book called Bounce. He talks about practice, and he basically comes to the premise that nobody is born with certain skill sets, and that if you look back through people's lives, and he was referencing table tennis, you know, he was talking about one guy who was really, really good at receiving a ball short. And he went back and talked to this guy and said, why can you do this? And he said, I don't know, it's just a skill. And he started delving into it more and more and asking him more and more questions. And it turned out that when this guy first started playing table tennis, he learned in his garage, and he had no room to stand back because his garage was so small.
He
built up the skill, and through practice, that he could only play, not only, but he built the skill that he became very good at receiving the ball short because he couldn't stand back. And so that helps us understand that most people throughout their life have built a skill set based on life experiences, and everybody's life experiences are probably different, but they can be taught. Those things can be taught. So I'm definitely more on the side of science in that question than I am on the side of art. It's practice. Everything you can teach people things, And if they practice them, they get better at them. And the more you practice, the better you get.
Yeah, I actually agree with things you just said. Okay, so as you said, you have to have some knowledge and you have to have some skills and to practice them. But is it more important than knowing right people? Is having the relevant certifications more important than knowing right people?
What do you mean by the right people?
I mean, people who are in industry, or people who can hire you, or, you know, you maybe have a friend who has company who wants to do some security awareness training, so he hires you because he knows you have ambition and you have knowledge to do that thing, you know?
So okay.
Is it more important having right people or knowing right people or having a right certifications?
So I think that for me, I would prefer to have the right people, because you can practice. This is going back to what we were just saying.
Yeah.
You can practice to get the certifications, right? Because to pass an exam, you just practice, right? But if your mindset isn't right, or your approach to problem solving isn't strong, or isn't the thing that you're really good at, then that's going to be an issue. And if you are lazy or, you know, interested, then yeah, you can have all the certifications in the world, but if you're lazy, you're not interested in the work, then, you know, why is somebody going to hire you?
Yeah.
In previous jobs, I've recruited people, I've recruited in, you know, my entire team, and I have taken people on who had no certifications, and were not even in security, but wanted to learn, and demonstrated to me that they wanted to learn, demonstrated to me that they had an interest in security, demonstrated that they are good at problem solving and learning and that sort of stuff. And I've gone, yeah, you're going to be our new security analyst. And you know, I've had other people come up with certifications, and I've asked them problem solving type questions as part of the interview process. And I'm not looking for the exact answer to my problem solving question. I'm looking for how you would approach it, and how you would approach the problem to find the solution. And some people with certifications have had terrible answers. So for me, yeah, it's the person. The problem there is, how do you get yourself seen and known in the industry without those certifications? Because unfortunately, HR processes are pretty poor, and you know, you might advertise for, let's say a security operations center analyst. And you see the job descriptions and you see the requirements, and it says it must have a degree and it must be CISSP, you know, CISP certified. Why do you need a CISP? Why do you need a degree to be a SOC analyst? You need to be a problem solver. You need to understand how things work, and you need to understand how that might have happened, that alert or thing that you've seen. CISP is irrelevant. But the HR process says, well, you know, he must have a CISP. Well, no, that's not true. That's not correct. I think it's difficult, and certificates definitely get you a foot in the door from a HR process point of view. But then after that, I hope that the hiring manager sees the person rather than the certificate.
Yeah, because companies do not look for certifications. They look for people who will be right for the position.
Yeah, hopefully.
Okay, so if let's say if you're starting right now, all over again, like you have 20 years, what courses or what certifications would you get right now?
So what that massively depends on what job you want. What job are we talking about here? Do you want me to be a pen tester, or do you want me to be a SOC analyst, for example, or do you want me to be a head of IT security?
Okay, let's say pen tester, because that's the most popular job right now. Physical pen
okay.
tester.
Yeah, okay. So there aren't many certificates or qualifications for physical pen testing, social engineering. And so you have to try and come in through the sort of the back door, I'd say. And by that, to not many companies in the UK, especially, purely focus on physical pen testing, physical sort of social engineering. You have to have a blend of skills. And so to get a foot in the door, I would suggest sitting any of the sort of industry standard pen test type qualifications. And that could be OSCP, it could be the Czech registered tester, the cyber scheme, Tiger scheme. There's lots of different schemes within the UK that are government recognized. They will get you a foot in the door. When you get your foot in the door, and again, this should probably be part of your interview questions to your potential employer, you need to ask them, what are my opportunities? I'm really interested in social engineering. I'm really interested in physical security. What have you got that can help me progress down that line? And if the answer is good, then yeah, you've got your foot in the door and you take that job and the company helps you and puts you on training, and then you know
the rest
you get
is history.
So yeah, that would be what I would suggest if you want to, you know, start in the pen test arena and then sort of specialize your skill sets, not just for pen testing, but for also for the social engineering and the physical security as well.
I mean, I ask you this question because there is some companies in the USA, like RTA with Red Team Alliance, who offer physical security courses, and you know, it's actually good courses. But the problem is that many people are not in USA or don't have money to pay for those courses. So
yeah.
I'm asking because many people are like in Asia, Russia, where they cannot travel to USA, and right now you cannot even more. So that's why I'm asking, what are some courses or certifications that you would recommend on starting?
Yeah. So it gets really difficult with the physical side, because there are courses, absolutely, but recognized certificates to say you are a recognized social engineer, you are a recognized physical security person, as far as I'm aware, there aren't that many. And so if that is what you want to do and you are based in, you know, Europe, you're not based in the US and you haven't got the cash, my suggestion would be learn as much as you can possibly learn and then start, you know, blogging about it, doing podcasts about it, tweet about it. Do LinkedIn articles if you have to, but you have to put yourself out there and make yourself become a recognized person that has that skill set. If you don't do that, then nobody's going to know that you can do those things, and nobody's going to recognize that you've got those qualities or those skills.
Yeah, engage with community, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. So engage with the community, you know, do talks. We're in a difficult situation now, but again, the positive side of the situation that we're in at the moment is that most talks are virtual.
Yeah.
So most conferences are virtual these days. So, you know, look at DEF CON, look at Black Hat, or any of the B-side talks, or anything along those lines. Most of them are virtual, and that lowers the barrier for people outside of those countries to talk at those places and attend. That would be my suggestion. Try and get yourself out there. Try and get yourself known. Publish articles, publish blogs, even if it's just comments and stuff and things that you've seen, but that have a social engineering angle to them, do that. That is the best way of getting yourself known in the industry and in, within the circle.
Yeah, that's actually a good tip, let's say, tip for starting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, look at DeviantOlam. Has he got any certifications that says he's can physically bypass stuff? Yeah, he's probably got some locksmith qualifications or something along those lines. But it's not what gets him the job, is it? That's not what gets him the work. What gets him the work is he goes out there and talks about it.
Yeah. Everybody knows who DeviantOlam is.
Exactly. And he's well known in the industry for being the guy who bypasses physical security.
Yeah.
You can do that. There are opportunities for other people to do that. And, you know, he is doing something really great and he's knowledge sharing with the industry. That is an awesome thing to do. Everybody can do that.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, now you said that you were in both worlds, in digital part of security and in the physical part. So
yeah.
What would you say today is most important, digital or physical aspect of security?
Neither. Both are important. And it's a balance. It's a balance, you know. And people, we're not talking about people in that equation either. And people are important. I think this is a really interesting point because everybody seems to focus on one thing, whether that be the digital security or the physical security, and not the two together, and not the people. And I think where we're not doing so great in the industry is recognizing that all those things are interlinked. And we seem to be really good at talking about digital exploits and vulnerabilities. And what we're not so great talking about is people. We're not so great about talking about the physical side. And I had this exact conversation with a client just today. And they're talking about us coming and testing some critical national infrastructure. And I said, yeah, that's fine. We can do that. Have you tested your physical security? Because you are critical national infrastructure, you are protecting something really, really important. It's brilliant that you're testing the digital side, but are you testing the physical side? And they went, oh, well, no. Well, okay, so, you know, when you go back to the business with a report that says, yeah, our digital security is brilliant, are you also saying that your physical security hasn't been tested as part of this
test? Yeah.
There's not one answer to that question. It's a combination of things and a real balance. And my experience is that the physical security team doesn't often talk to the digital or the cybersecurity team and vice versa. And that is not a good situation to be in. Those two protectors of a company need to have really good, honest conversations with each other. And they need to be almost best friends because the two things are so reliant on each other. And I'm not sure that that is well known at the moment.
Yeah, I actually agree completely. Okay, you said that this is community, I mean, we said that this community is very small and it's expanding, it's quite new. Would you say, I mean, how do you think interest in and awareness of social engineering and physical security in general will change in the next few years?
I hope it will change. And I hope the awareness will get better. I'm not sure how, because a lot of that is driven by the business themselves and their knowledge and their insight. And I think what we, as the sort of pen test side, and the testing side of the industry needs to do better is not scaremonger so much, but make everybody aware that all of these things are actually genuinely linked, and that there is no point hiring somebody to do a pen test of a system, but then not look at the perimeter security of the perimeter that is protecting that system.
Yeah.
So yeah, I hope that the awareness develops and gets better, and the visibility of physical security gets better. Yeah, you look at the news. If I go and talk to a board of directors, and they will say to me, "Are we, under attack from China, for example?" Let's use them as an example. Are we under attack from China? And I go, "Well, I don't know." But what? Because they've read that in the news. So that question has come from somebody in the news, and it's probably because they're, a Western company, and they're either UK or US based, and so the media portrays China to be a threat. But what's not gaining visibility in the board of directors' eyes is a burglary, because that is a small thing that probably happens relatively frequently and is seen as a physical security problem, but isn't gaining a lot of media attention. Now, big things, big burglaries, if someone steals a massive piece of art, or steals lots of jewelry over a bank holiday weekend from supposedly a jewelry safe that's supposed to be really secure in Hatton Garden, yes, that makes the news. But there is no link, and this is what we're not very good at, there's no link when we go and talk to the board of directors to say, well, if I break into the cybersecurity side of your system, I can weaken your physical security, and vice versa. If I break into the physical security side of your system, that gets me onto the IT computer side, then I can now steal your jewels or your money using the IT security and cybersecurity weaknesses. We're not very good at making that link, and that is our problem as the people who are testing these systems and raising awareness and raising that visibility. We're not brilliant at linking those two things together when we publish stories, in the media or on blogs or stuff like that. So I think there needs to be some improvement there.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, now this is quite an interesting one. Do you have any story where you were on engagement and someone recognized you?
No. And that's interesting. It's an interesting question.
Okay, but how would you react? Like, you go on engagement and you actually see a person who knows you and who knows what you do. How would you react?
Yeah. Okay, well, that would be massively dependent on the situation, but realistically speaking, the people that are going to recognize me are probably in the security world, and if I'm on an engagement, I've probably been hired by them or their boss or somebody yeah. underneath them, so they probably would either know I was coming or realized that their boss had hired me and I'd got in. If it was a friend who wasn't in security and I was on an engagement and they recognized me, then yeah, that might be interesting. It might be interesting to see how they react. I couldn't really predict how they'd react, but you'd have to play it by ear, and maybe they might challenge you. If they do, that's really, really good, and that should be recognized that they challenged me. if they didn't challenge me, then, you know, maybe I would go over and talk to them and say, why haven't you challenged me? You know what I do. Why are you not challenging me? It hasn't happened. So it's difficult to answer, but I think it would massively depend on the circumstance and how it happened and why. But yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, I was thinking about, like, some people, like, let's say we actually mentioned him, David Olof.
Yeah.
Does he get recognized on engagement? How do you do it in those situations? Like, oh, I know you. You're the guy who breaks into buildings. And you're in my company, like, oh, wait.
Yeah. And if that happened, I would say something like, yeah, you're absolutely right. You recognize me. I've been hired, you know, assuming this is true, I've been hired by so-and-so to do this for you. It's great that you've challenged me. Let's make a note of it. I'll call it in. And, you know, either I'll be allowed to carry on or that's the end of the engagement. But if somebody recognizes you and challenges you, you should really recognize that, because that is a positive result for the company, because awareness is happening and working, which is great.
Yeah. Okay, now this one is a little bit, let's say, a corporate one.
Okay.
Many countries with less developed security industries suffer from social engineering attacks, which cost them a lot of money. Nevertheless, a common argument given is that there are many other issues that need to be addressed before social engineering attacks. How would you respond to this argument?
I'd agree. I'd absolutely agree with that. And this depends on the corporate appetite for risk. And, you know, ideally speaking, there would be a risk register of some description that would have, you know, likelihood and impact variables, and somebody would go through all of the possible attack scenarios and think about the likelihoods and the impacts, and they would draw up a risk score. And, you know, in an ideal world, something will come out as a high risk and something a medium and something as a low risk. Now, if the impact from physical social engineering is really, really high, and it's higher than a cyber attack of some description, you know, through the website or something along those lines, then yeah, it's the company's decision, the corporate decision, that they should tackle social engineering issues first. But if a cyber attack is going to have a higher impact and a higher likelihood, then it's going to be a higher risk, and that's the thing that they should tackle first. So, yeah, to me, the answer is, what does your risk register say? What should you be tackling first?
Yeah, I understand and agree. Okay, now, of many things you do in your job, which one makes your heart beat fastest?
Social engineering. Social engineering is the thing that makes my heart. And, you know, I have done this for a good few years now. I am not an expert at it. I have practiced it a lot, but I still get very nervous. Social engineering. You do. And again, I talk about this in the DEF CON talk. Nerves are natural. Everybody I know who is a good social engineer still gets nervous, and I've asked them this question and I've talked to them about it. People still get nervous, and so yeah, that is the thing that gets my heart beating a lot faster, not necessarily in a good way, because it's nerves. It's not necessarily an excitement. It's a nerves thing that's making my heart beat faster.
Yeah.
But you know, it's that again is not a negative thing, and don't let that put you off if you want to get into this field. It's just one of those things I think that you have to accept as part of the job, and you will learn to deal with nerves and not let them affect you so much, and that comes with practice.
As you said, there is one guy who enters the bathroom and And oh, it's called notice that it's out of order.
Yeah. And I do that. I do exactly that. So that was a tip from a colleague of mine.
Yeah.
I wasn't doing that at first. And then I thought, I'm taking that tip. I'm stealing that tip and I'm doing that. And it is a great thing to do. It really is, especially when you're first starting and you're doing your first few engagements and you've not quite got the hang of the nerves and how they affect you yet. It's definitely a really good tip to do. And it helps because you disappear for a bit. And, you know, if anybody was looking for you, you've gone. And so they then forget about you. And I know some people who will sit, and this is perfectly legitimate, will sit in that toilet for the whole day. And they will come out when the office is empty.
That's smart, actually.
Yeah, exactly. It's a perfectly legitimate attack because that could happen. So, yeah, why not?
Okay, now, what's the one question you wish someone would ask you but never did?
The one question.
It could be some interview, it could be some friend, it could be employer, anyone.
The one question. What's my favorite ice cream?
That's like actually a good question. Yeah. Me too. A lot.
I like ice cream. Yeah. I like ice cream. And so, yeah, my favorite ice cream. So I spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and there is an ice cream chain in the Middle East called Baskin Robbins. And they do really good ice cream, really good ice cream, like the best ice cream I think I've ever had. But you don't get them many other places. They don't. There used to be one shop in Oxford Street in London that was a Baskin Robbins, and there were none in the UK other than that one. And so, yeah, every time I go to the Middle East, I always look on Google Maps for where the nearest Baskin and Robbins is, and I go and have Baskin and Robbins.
Yeah. I get you, and I understand you, actually.
Yeah, what's your favorite ice cream?
Well, there's not any kind of ice cream I don't like, but the fruit ones I actually love. Kiwi is my favorite. Yeah.
Kiwi, okay.
Yeah, that's the one that I'm like always can eat, and I always love it.
Okay, I'll have to look out for that.
Yeah. Okay, now, can you tell me why Ghosty? Your Twitter username is _ghosty_. Is there a story behind it or anything?
Sort of. It's actually a shortened nickname. So a long time ago, I had a friend called Colin. And the very first time, I knew Colin from school. And the very first time I went round to his house and I met his mum, and it was with two friends, and the two friends walked in first, and they walked into the front room, and Colin introduced the two friends to his mum, and I was walking in behind the two friends, and I got talking to Colin's dad, and so there was a delay between the two friends going into the front room and me appearing into the front room.
Okay.
And so his mum said to Colin, when I walked into the front room, "And who's this, the Holy Ghost?" Which was a common saying, you know, a long time ago. And I think that Colin's parents were Scottish. And it was a common saying back then that, you know, "Who's this, the Holy Ghost?" kind of thing. Or "Who are you, the Holy Ghost?" And so, yeah, that was where my nickname originated from. And in the old days when CB radio was a thing, that was my cool handle on the CB. It was the Holy Ghost on there. And then it got shortened because it was two words and one word was easier to say on the radio. And it just it just morphed, it just changed over time into ghosting.
Yeah, I like to ask this question to a lot of people because everybody has some kind of Twitter handle or, as they say, hacker username or something. And I like to hear a story behind it because there are many interesting stories as yours. So that's why I ask you this question. Cause
so where does yours come from then?
Actually, mine is very, very lame because I didn't know what to put in some site and I was like, are you, the question was, are you a male? And I was like, no, man.
Okay.
I typed no man and it was, oh, it's taken. So it was like, no man 29. Oh, it's good. Actually, that's perfect. So, yeah, mine is actually very lame. So yeah.
Okay, that's still a good story.
Yeah, but I like it because it's simple. As you said, it's simple, it's short, and I can use it anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for this wonderful interview. For the last thing, I'll ask you, where can people find you?
So the best way to find me is on Twitter. And yeah, the Twitter handle is ghosty with an underscore at the end. So the at symbol and then ghosty. ghostie and then an underscore at the end.
Okay, thank you very much for this wonderful interview. You help us a lot because every little thing somebody says that is in industry helps us a lot. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad it's helpful. You're welcome.